I want to skip the sermon today and just listen to all the music that we've heard today all over again. But we won't do that. A question I get asked often by newcomers to our congregation is it okay that I'm an atheist? Now, you have to admit it's pretty brave to come to a church when you're an atheist. And I want to honor their question. And I say, we have many different beliefs about God in this congregation, including atheists, and you are welcome here. What I want to say is, tell me about the God that you don't believe in. You will find there are a lot of people in this congregation who don't believe in that God either. Now, I say that God because we don't really know what someone means when they say God or when they say they don't believe in God. Really, God, in a way, is our own internal construct based upon what we've been exposed to, how we've been influenced by the world. Surveys in this country have very high numbers of people that say they believe in God. Is it like 85% or something like that? And so, you know, that could make atheists, people who are clear that there's some version of God they don't believe in, that could make them feel a little minority-like. But I always want to say in the question, the yes or no question, do you believe in God? Could you be more specific, please? Now, this idea of shared meaning of God is more of a challenge for UUs than it would be for Christians or Muslims or Jewish communities. Many of the folks here, many of you and those that are part of this congregation, left other churches because they couldn't reconcile with the God, the version of God that was presented to them. In fact, the word God here in this space is often problematic in and of itself, partly because of some of the baggage that people bring, some of the pain that's associated with how they relate to God. Often, we have readings in church. We had one a month or so ago, part of Scott's sermon, where I think I did the reading. I think I said the name of God 71 times in this reading. And people just literally shut down. They can't hear the message of the words because that word itself is a barrier that blocks them from deeper meaning. Now, prayers are a challenge as well. UU ministers like to call it the thesaurus of God names to avoid saying the name God. Interdependence, spirit of life, the web of all, the deep meaning that resides. You get the feeling of it. It's almost humorous. But it's certainly indicative of some of our challenges. And when Scott and I are writing prayers, we try different words, hoping that one of the words will resonate. But none of the words will deter. In my sermon last week, Why I'm Not an Atheist, I sort of described my own journey, my own relationship to God. I talked about the versions of God that I had rejected and the versions of God that I embraced. And I think Megan did a lovely job in her reflection articulating this idea of the struggle and the desire to have a relationship with something that is greater than us. And that lovely poem said it well also. The author said, it's ridiculous to still believe in God, to say the word divine and feel it blush purple in that place where you still wake at night. But there it is, heavy on your head. I think we need to have a conversation about God. That's why I chose to do these two sermons. I think it would be a useful conversation for us to shape a new view together. I want to make it clear from the very start that I am not anti-atheist. In fact, I would probably be labeled an atheist by people who have a very specific definition of God. But in my role as a religious leader of this congregation, I want to make sure that you know what it is that you don't believe in. And I want to make sure that you don't close yourself off to dimensions of spirituality that could be meaningful and deeply enriching. So, why do we bother with this idea of God at all? Well, whether or not there is a God, humans would have created one, and they did. It's a mechanism that humans use to answer the deepest questions of where did we come from? What is the source? Why is there suffering? What is our purpose? In human history, some people consider an evolution of God, starting with God is in the trees and the animals, of animism, and then polytheism. Everything's a god. There are multiple gods. And then this idea that we learn from the Hebrew scriptures, that there are lots of gods, but we should only pay attention to one God. That's the message of the Old Testament. And then, of course, distilling down into the monotheism, which is the dominant idea of God in our culture today. In fact, our country is actually steeped in this idea of monotheism. In the Hebrew scriptures, as I mentioned, Yahweh was a jealous God, and he wanted there to be only one God. And he succeeded. In our Judeo-Christian culture, there's one God that we are, in certain circles, allowed to believe in. But monotheism, by definition, is a very restricted access to God. In fact, Christians add another layer on that, that Jesus is the way to the God. So you can't access the God but through Jesus. Now, of course, all of the monotheistic religions have wonderful ways of engaging in spirituality and can be deeply meaningful in life. But monotheism in itself is a limited access to power, a limited and an issue of control. We see that in the history of Christianity as it was used to dominate and oppress people. But even if we reject this idea of a single God, this God of the monotheistic one and only God, we're still stuck in some Western ways of thinking about the design. One of them comes from the Enlightenment and our rational sense and our scientific method of wanting to know. If you can't prove it by data, then it doesn't exist. We get stuck with that form of thinking. And then we're stuck with the inheritance of dualistic form of thinking. Like everything's a yes or a no, a believe, don't believe, real, not real, theism, atheism. When maybe it's both and. So I want to kind of blow apart our Western perspectives on God. And I'm going to do that by telling you about Hinduism. Now, I am not even going to begin to do justice to the complexity and depth of this religion, but I think there's some very useful ideas here that we can use on our journey to find some meaning for us in the ideas of God. The primary concept of Hinduism is that God is one and God is many. And this plays out in two basic ideas of God. Brahman is the God is one. It's the mysterious. They actually say that form of God has no attributes. It just is. Atman is the form of God that lives within each being, that is present. It's the foundation of our own reality. And these forms of God are the same, but seen from different perspectives, like a prism. And our task in life is to find the harmony between that God and this, the God without attributes and the God with attributes being our version, us. And then they take this idea of God is many, that this idea of divine reality, God is many, but also is one. Many of you who have some exposure to Hinduism immediately think of elephant-headed gods with 17 arms. There are many, many, many gods in the Hindu tradition, and they're considered all manifestations of Brahman, all manifestations of the same spirit. Divine reality is many, but they are all one, whether they're named Kali, Shiva, Vishnu, Krishna. Because the idea is everyone needs to find a God that's going to help them harmonize with that greater sense of divine spirit. And we are all very, very different. Frankly, I love this idea. I love the idea of finding that version of the divine spirit that you can relate to, you can have a relationship with. So when asked how many Hindu gods there are, they say, well, there are either 36, 3,366, or 330 million. Now, of course, they're doing that on purpose to play with you. It's a fanciful number, an unknown number. Not only are there basic gods, but there are multiple versions of every god. So you could be a Krishna follower, but you could be focusing on the baby Krishna. Or you could be Shiva, but you're a follower of Shiva in his feminine form. Because the gods in Hinduism play with different genders. The same god can have different genders or no gender. Can be blue or red or green. Can have 8 arms or 10 arms or 1,000 arms. But each has a purpose and a story. Each arm is holding something that tells a story about that, the role of that God in your life. The other aspect of Hinduism that I think is useful for us to think about is that religion is not a Sunday morning thing for them. It's not a going to church kind of thing. Religion is life. Temples are open all the time and have certain rituals at certain times a day. You can drop in at any time to pay homage to your particular god that's the god maybe of your village or your city. There are shrines at every unique tree. Every big rock has its own shrine and probably its own attendant at that shrine. There are also many choices for how you can practice spirituality in Hinduism. Everything from the aesthetic yoga practitioner who sits in silence meditating to people that dance with the god Shiva in an ecstatic dance, people who study, people who pray. There are multiple, multiple forms of engagement, recognizing that everyone's need for how to connect with God will be different. Now, all these blue and green, gender-switching, elephant-headed gods may make us think that Hinduism is trivial, that it's so playful that it doesn't have any depth. But Hinduism is one of the oldest known religions on earth, and the Vedic texts of Hinduism, about 2,000 years old or more, are some of the most deeply theological texts ever written. Written in a primitive Bronze Age culture. You look at the nature of India and our world today, and you may say, how can a culture like that, such a complex, challenged culture, be the birthplace of these texts? And I would say, if that's your perspective, then you need to speak to somebody who's been to India. And you need to remove the Western capitalist view of what spirituality and success can look like. But the thing that I find the most powerful about the Vedic texts is that they solve the language problem. They solve the naming problem. And maybe this will be a solution for Scott and I in our prayers going forward. Because they distill God down to one sound, and that sound is Om. There are descriptions of Om, mysterious and inexhaustible, the infinite language and knowledge, the experience of breath and everything that exists. But I love a culture that has 330 million gods and one sound for God. They have made God work for them, wouldn't you say? They've found a way to engage deeply, recognizing God is the many, God is the one. And all of their actions, the ways they relate to God, are all with this goal of restoring the harmony between the greater sense of the divine reality and each individual, and indeed, the world itself. We do namaste here in this congregation. Namaste is a Hindu greeting of the Atman in me, the divine reality in me, greets the divine reality in you. That form of connection itself is an expression of God, an expression of the connection of you to me and our shared reality of the same divine spirit. I think when I gaze upon the landscape of Hinduism, I think it kind of makes our questions about what God is seem kind of small. This idea of an on-off switch, God, no God, believe, don't believe. Hinduism answers that God is everything. It's you and it's me and it's that tree out there and it's the greater spirit and it's understood and it's not understood. Kind of like the song that Celia shared, name unnamed, hidden and shown, knowing and known, Gloria. I think if you were to ask a Hindu if they believed in God, they would say, what is belief? What does belief have to do with it? Do I believe in air? Do I believe in trees? Do I believe in being itself? So what do we do with all this, this great massive idea of Hinduism and they're blowing up our minds about how to relate to God? What do we do with this? One of the things I take away is this idea of taking God lightly and taking God seriously simultaneously. It's important for us to know that each of us have some idea when the word God is spoken, what we mean by that word. Whether it's father, mother, whether it's abstract, whether it's a concept. We have an image. We have an idea. Even those who are rejecting that are in relationship to what they're rejecting. And that relationship is the key word about how to relate to God. For those of you who have rejected the idea of a God, I invite you to consider moving beyond rejection to an idea that doesn't serve you, to the possibility of one that does. I invite you to consider a new relationship with a concept that fits your idea of the meaning of life, what connects you, what sustains you. We all have a theology. We all have our own answers to questions about the meaning of life, whether we are conscious of it or not. So what else can we take from Hinduism? Whatever God you decide to have a relationship, let it be alive. Let it be about connection, harmony, music. Let it not be about rejection. If you need to reject certain ideas of God, go for it. I think it's very healthy. And you, if you heard my story last week, I rejected many versions of God along my path. My path, of course, that I'm still on. And of course, take another cue from Hinduism and don't limit yourself to one concept, to one flavor. Let your idea of the divine be as big or as small as you can imagine it being. You don't have to know the answer. Last week, I told you about the story of how I told my father about my spiritual beliefs and how he had this aghast look on his face. Where did you get that? You can't do that. You can't make up your own religion. So we laughed at that story last week. We're laughing at here, but are we doing that to ourselves? Are we holding ourselves to this false idea that there's stuff that we don't believe and therefore we don't have anything that we can believe? Do we restrict ourselves from finding meaning and purpose in whatever way the divine can reach us and connect with us? So I had a lot of definitions last week about at various stages of along my path in relationship to God. And I want to end with the idea of engaged agnosticism. Agnosticism, of course, is you don't know whether God is true or not. You don't know. But engaged agnosticism is living into the not knowing. It's leaving space for what is possible and what resonates for you. So I'm rethinking my approach to the newcomer question when they say, is it okay if I don't believe in God? I still do want to ask the question, tell me about the God you don't believe in. Because I think that that's an important conversation so that people can move beyond, so I can understand what it is that they're saying no to. But the follow-up question, I think, would be, tell me what makes you feel alive. Tell me when you feel connected to something greater to yourself. Tell me about when you feel in awe of the mystery. Tell me about how you feel, when and how that you feel in harmony with a greater sense of the life force. That is the question. That is the dialogue with yourself, with each other, and with something that is greater than any of us. Living the questions, being open to the presence, finding the harmony. Namaste.